conjugation, sex and bacteria, just so that we have it right. But did someone put the earlier drawings up on the board? Did someone got it? To recall that we were talking about F plus cell, and I made it with F minus cell, F minus cell with female cell, so called. And we both have genomic information. The sex cell is associated with the male cell that has the self-replicating plasmid. And self-replicating plasmid codes for sex villi, and then as soon as the receptor site matching between the bacteria occurs, it is revealed as a hollow tube, an enzymatic reaction that breaks through the cell wall on the female side. A copy of the self-replicating plasmid is made in a linear form, and then it ends up here, converting this cell to an F plus cell. So if I ask you on an exam, what's the result of an F plus, F minus mating is two F plus cells? But we know that that's not a very stable plasmid, and that it will, over a period of months, break up. But remember, that's a period of months in which for every 20 minutes or so, depending upon the microorganism, it's dividing in two. And that self-replicating plasmid, as well as any non-self-replicating plasmid, will be copied by the genomic host cell transcriptase. So those copies will always be made. So next generation, next generation, next generation. And also note that the presence or absence of a non-self-replicating plasmid has no bearing on its mating type. So an F minus cell, an F plus cell, an HFR cell, or an F prime cell, all of those could have a non-self-replicating plasmid. That's usually a question that gets people. It's not related to the mating type. And you can have more than one, in fact, it commonly has many. So you can have multiple non-self-replicating plasmids themselves. Each one could be made the same thing or people. So that's our first mating. That sort of sets the tone for what we're doing. Well, then we have another type of mating. And this one is an HFR. HFR stands for high frequency recombinant. HFR. And it's going to be a male cell, so it's going to have a sex cell, and it's going to be made with an F minus cell. High frequency recombinant, the recipient female cell, the final cell. And then you have something different. Notice that the self-replicating plasmid is now integrated into the genome of the HFR cell. Different. It's still considered extra-genomic because in addition to the main chromosome, it's integrated into the genome. So points of reference, you put a D here, and a D in here, and a C, and a D, and an E. Yeah. And when it mates, it will then start in the middle roughly of the self-replicating plasmid where it's integrated. And it will then start sending over a linear copy. And the linear copy will have something different. A to B there, B to B there. So it trails across, it's carrying the genes with it. Now, theoretically, if their mating was long enough, the entire donor, a copy of the entire donor chromosome we cut it off. But that only happens in the laboratory setting. It happens when we have the mating occurring in auger. So we have a mating and then we add auger on them so they can't separate. It does not occur in nature. It does not occur on the land. So what happens is that we have the points of reference. We'll have some A and trailing edge will replace the A and replace the B. So we have something to show what's on this. Right. So the leading edge of this integrated plasmid makes it into the cytoplasm. The A gene will actually substitute, and so will the B gene. So we'll have a substitution. Now, in one of the handouts that you have, one of the overheads you have in the packet there, it actually shows an integrated. That's an unusual situation. More of a cartoonist error than it is reality. It can occur, but it's a very unusual situation. So we'll think of what normally would happen. What normally happens is a substitution. So then we end up with this cell that has a big A, big B, then a little C, a little D, and a little E. That self-replicating plasma cord here is lost. So that extra piece of integrated plasma that made it across is lost. What we end up then is just simply the genetic information from the previous genomic host cell. And so this new cell is an F minus cell with new genes. New genetic information. Now to do this experiment, it takes a little bit of effort because for every donor gene, we have to have a recipient cell with a defective donor gene that we're trying to replace. So we can see that it happens. So for example, if they were both big A, we wouldn't know that it happened. So you have to have one replace the other. And that's not easily gotten. You have to find a cell that has in the right sequence, the right deficiency. But notice that this recipient cell did not become a male cell, not a donor cell. And so this information is not spread. The cell can divide into and so on. Now we have a variety of HFR strains. That is, this integration can occur at different points in chromosome. So we could have A, B, C, but we'd also have C, D, D, or B, F, G, and so on. And wherever it integrates, it will send across in the sequence from where it integrated. A, then B, then C, or C, then D, then E, and so on. Well, we can have this control a little bit. We can monitor the situation. And we can distinguish which of those two or three genes have come across in this high-frequency recombinant, which means a good chance of recombining genes, high-frequency recombinant. So we have high-frequency recombinant strains that give lots of A and less percentage of getting across B, moving across B, and it's still less percentage against C, because what happens is they'll break apart. So what we can do is we can put them in a whirling blender, like we're going to make a daiquiri or some kind of drink, right? Mojito, whatever. Right? And so we have this, this blender, and we have the organisms in there, and we mix them together, the male and female cells, and the donors are interacting with the recipients, and we let 1 minute go by, and then we put it on a mild, okay, disruptive. It's called an interrupted mating experiment. And we follow what traits happen in the first minute. So in the first minute, A came across. Then we do the experiment again, start them all over again, let them go for 2 minutes. And maybe in 2 minutes, A and B come across. Because again, the recipient cell is deficient in A and B, and when it picks up the donor's good A and B, we can see that occurs. And then if we go 3 minutes or 4 minutes, then we get A, B, C, and so on. Afterwards, after a certain short period of time, after a few minutes, at beyond the third one, then they break on their own, and you know, all bets are off in terms of what's happening. But we can get a good, clear idea of the sequence of A, B, and C. Then we use the next one, which gives us C coming across in the first minute, D in the second minute, then E in the third minute, and so on. So now we know the relationship of A, B, C, D, E. We know the order. And we can continue to do this as long as we have right HMR strains and right donor recipients relative to the markers that we're looking for. It takes a lot of effort to do these experiments. They're very tedious. Because you have to have a lot of mutants and a lot of cells to be efficient for whatever you're carrying so that you can see that it happens. Lots of media that has to be developed. And once you have it, you have to then prove that it's there. So for example, if the organism can't make tryptophan, and now it can make tryptophan, in the first instance, you had to add tryptophan to the media for it to survive. Okay. In the second instance, it can grow on media and have no tryptophan in it. So for every one of these characteristics, we have to have a screen to identify the recipient cell has in fact picked up that particular characteristic. But it's all doable. Just be patient. Well, this led to then mapping the entire chromosome. So we can map the genome. And this began in the 1960s and in the 70s and so on. And in the Journal of Bacteriology, they would literally have a centerfold that would look like this. Staple would usually in the middle. They would fold it out. And you would then see, if you take a look at this, this is a clock. This happens to have 100 minutes in it. So it has the 0, 100. Remember, we've got a circular chromosome. And starting at the zero time, and then it's just arbitrary, you have to start someplace in a circle. And then they went around and they found that we have the leucine and the arginine and the lactose and another arginine and all the way around. Entire function. Everything that this cell can do is needed. And we know the relationship of each one. So we know what genes they have. And each one of these is an operon. It's not just a gene. So this is a gene sequence. And so we can see all of them all around. Well, once we learned how to do it once, we then started doing the other organisms. And every couple of months in the Journal of Bacteriology, there would be another fold-out. Centerfold. And we would have E. coli and Salmonella and Shigella, and we have all these different organisms. Well, by the time we got into the 80s, we had done this, and it was old hat. It was something we needed graduate students to do. It was something tedious, but they can do it. They'd show them how to do it, and they just have to find the right mutants, they have the deficiencies, develop the right screens, whatever they're looking for, and start doing these things. Meanwhile, the old professors would say, well, you know, we got the students doing this stuff. We should be able to do something different. Let's do eukaryotes instead of prokaryotes. They're a little more complicated. We've got genes and we've got chromosomes. So now we start looking at chromosomes. So we start something small, some fungal organisms and so on, and just a few chromosomes. You'd isolate the chromosome in one lab and get one chromosome, and then you get another chromosome, and you start working on it. We find what genes were associated with what chromosome, and then begin to map it. So by the time we ended in the 80s, we were pretty much into doing this in a stepwise manner. And of course, somebody wants to jump ahead always. And so by the mid-90s, we say, let's do the human chromosome. So 92, 94, groups get together. International conventions. Chromosomes were assigned to countries. France wanted a chromosome that had muscular dystrophy on it because they liked Jerry Lewis. Strange thing, a big, big bar there. Here we get, you know, sort of a strange-looking guy that obviously has some kind of medical issues and, you know, steroids and so on, and he has a Labor Day telephone. That's all we know about him. Right? But in France, he's got all these old movies and they just love him. So they wanted his chromosome. And so they got his chromosome. And the country broke out the human genome and got the genome around the world. The French were very eager to get theirs done, so they actually started automating the process. And so what they thought was going to take until the year 2015 or more, they then sold the gene machines to everybody else would do it. And now we've got it done already. Now, this human genome project, we skipped over certain sections, so we sort of cheated a little bit. These are large sections of the genetic information for humans that have no significant genes that we can find. And that may be this group of viruses that have inserted themselves in there, something we just don't know what it is. So we just went to hide one. Now, the first time we decided to do this for somebody specifically, rather than can we just do it, but can we do John? We heard of Watson and Crick, right? So we did one of theirs. And it cost about $1 million. So we did Watson. Watson at the time was in Cold Spring Harbor. He then made some stupid racial mistakes and statements and things like that. And he's no longer there. But he was there. And so they did his chromosome. It cost about $1 million. They've now got it down to $100,000 for like a full blown thing. Dropped by 10%. But if we do a focus one, which is probably what we need in practical sense, it's down to around $10,000. So for $10,000, you can do a pretty good down and dirty analysis of the high points of your genome. And we're not quite there to have it in everyday use, but we're getting closer. It gets more and more automated all the time. Now, something to keep in mind, it won't affect me because I will be in Ireland and watching the sun go down and the sun comes up here earlier. And I will post some wine or something. But basically, the problem that you're going to have to resolve is the following. In the early 1980s, when we had this strange problem that occurred in otherwise healthy young males in California, who developed diseases that were associated with an immunocompromised patient, but they weren't known to be immunocompromised. Also, they were talking about HIV infection and AIDS. But the insurance companies wanted to know about why these people were costing so much money. And so they began to realize that it was something to do with male homosexuals, but they couldn't really find them. But they knew that in certain areas, certain zip codes in San Francisco, there was a high percentage of male homosexuals. So by that zip code, they adjusted your insurance. It's the only thing they had. So by zip code alone, your insurance would go from $500 a month to $5,000 a month to $25,000 a month or whatever it took to get you off of that insurance. Because it was going to cost you a lot more than that. Okay. Now, what if we could determine your genome with a swab? Would the insurance company really want to know that? Now, most of you are too young to have an interest in getting life insurance. But at some point in time, the next few years, you will get life insurance. Some of you may have already. But within the next few years, you will get life insurance. And when you get your life insurance, there will be a questionnaire. And it's really interesting how the insurance company is so curious about your family. How is Aunt Susie? Did your mother ever have this problem or that problem? Did your father ever have it? They want to know all about your relatives and their illnesses. Because they're trying to get a rough approximation of what's going on in your genome. Again, they don't have the swab yet. But once they get the swab, and it will be down about $500 or less, then they're going to want it. Okay. The question is, do they get it? That's an open point. Again, I will be in Ireland and I won't worry about it, but you will have to deal with this because that's a question that's open. Is it your information? Can it be demanded of you? Can it be exchanged from one source to another that has it? Or not? Right now, that's an open question. We have all these questions about HIPAA, okay? All these rules about who can know whatever. But behind all that are insurance companies who want to know because they want to price your insurance company so they don't put your insurance policy so they make money and don't lose money. Insurance is based on pooled risk. If we know what the risks are, we can assess those prices much differently. We know you have a high risk for this disease or that disease. We're going to price it differently for the insurance company. Now, on the good side of that, so that's sort of a negative twist. We don't know where that's going to go. On the good side of that, we also have the possibility and the increasingly likelihood of tailoring drug treatment to a particular genomic information. Side effects of certain drugs are associated with certain genetic information. The effectiveness of one drug over another. You have five drugs for high blood pressure. Why does one work for this person and why does the other work for another person? That's genetic in large part. So we'll be able to use genomics, as it's called, genomics, the application of the information of your genome, we can use genomics then to tailor appropriate chemotherapy, treatment of cancers, treatment of chronic diseases, and so on. Okay. So there's going to be some good news there, too. So it's not that we don't want this information out, but we need to control the information. Another little nuance, again, a subtlety that's not yet in your view of things. You've heard of insurance companies, I'm sure. You've heard of the federal government. They have insurance, Medicare, and so on. The current discussion of health care, we don't want the government to own health care. Medicare is government health care. Well, several people. It's not there. But the idea is that we already have it in many people. And so basically, you may not be aware of another kind of insurance, and that's called self-insurance. That's when a company insures themselves. They collect the premiums, either directly having payment back to the employee, or they deduct what would have been earnings, and they put it into a pot. And then when you break your leg, they reach in that pot, and they pay the company. Now, they may have Blue Cross Blue Shield run the billing, but the pot of money is the company's, instead of the insurance company. Because the company says, well, my goodness, in a good year, we're paying on all these hundreds of thousands of dollars of health care, and we're not getting anything out of it. That's our money. Okay. So they call that self-insurance. It's really not an insurance policy in terms of health insurance. They may have insurance called a stop-loss insurance. That is a liability that one year they have $100 million worth of bills, and they only had $50 million set aside, so they're in a hole. Okay? And so they have an insurance company plan for the company to pick up any liability that they overextend themselves. That's not health care, that's a liability policy. And the reason I'm telling you that is that these companies can, as part of their pre-employment physical, pre-employment, can do the swab. So now, even if you get the job or not, may depend upon your genomics. Is that fair? The company says, oh, yeah. But other companies, the individual may say, wait, I'm a great pharmacist. I want to work with your company. And they say, well, I'm sorry. And they won't tell you this because the genomics, they said, well, we had so many people looking for the job, and you weren't picked. But even in the paperwork, you weren't picked because you're a high risk. Now, is that information to the company even before you become employed should have access to it? So there's a lot of questions about that. You will be involved on both sides of the line. You'll be involved on the genomic side, the positive side, the application of people's information and how we'll use the treatment. That'll be really neat stuff. And you'll be able to understand drug-to-drug interactions a little bit better. You'll be able to understand allergic reactions a little bit better. You'll be able to understand why drugs work for one patient and not another. Now, it will be down to this predator absence of a certain enzyme, something or other. The clock works and doesn't work. On the other side, you'll also be involved in as a consumer of healthcare. But it all began with people playing around late at night with whirring blenders and this kind of interrupted mating experiment. So the concept has been laid down in microbiology, applied to eukaryotic cells, and then ultimately applied to human cells. By the way, there are people working on dogs and cats and some of the interesting animals working on theirs as well. But we sort of put ourselves ahead. And monkeys and so on. Everybody has their own favorite organism or animal that they'd like done for. So we have that established with high-frequency recombinant babies. And again, the recipient cell remains a female cell. This is that new genetic information. Again, there's a cartoon here. You notice that on this one, they're showing the A and the B gene, and they also have this being integrated, okay? That's not generally where it happens. We're going to substitute the A and the B. They didn't make big A in the way, so maybe this is a good one. We'll try to show you by color. I'm going to try to do that. So they have a blue genome and a green genome. So they have a blue A, B, and C, and they have a green A, B, and C, and then they hope that that was going to work out. But traditionally, in genetics, we talk about the wild type, the functional type is the capital letter, and the mutant variety, the unusual type, is the small letter. And this is sort of awkward way to tell. But also, it's not completely, this may occur, but it's the rare event. And all this shows you is the kind of genes that we could be looking at again, time after mixing and different parents and such. I gave 1, 2, 3 minutes, you can see that there's different kinds of genes. Not very good. Okay, let's talk about F prime. Third type of mating. A Bok Fu continuum. There is our F prime male cell, and it's going to have cell I, and it's going to be mating with an F minus cell. And we have a genome here, and we have a genome here. And where is our plasma? Well, here's our plasma down here. So it's no longer part of the main chromosome. But it's not exactly like we saw in the other class. We have stolen the A gene, A to the any gene. We've taken the gene, and now it's part of the self-replicating plasmid. Now when we have a mating, we send over a linear copy. This and this. And then ultimately, we end up with the A over here. And then this is then converted to an F prime cell. So we have an F prime cell that has a self-replicating plasmid that's not integrated, but it's not the same as the F plus. It's got an extra piece of bacterial genome attached to it. And when it mates, it sends over a complete copy so that the second cell has a self-replicating plasmid with an A gene on it. So now it's a male cell, it's a donor cell, it's got sex villi, and the ability to copy itself. That's your case. And it's got a small piece of genetic information. This Latin is the gift that keeps on giving. Okay? Because the donor cell now will continually spread that AG. Now, that AG could be the ability to grow on certain media. It could be the ability to produce an exotoxin. It could be the ability to be resistant to an antimicrobial agent. So now we have, in a matter of minutes of a mating, we have a cell that could not grow on media, did not have a toxin, or was susceptible to an antibiotic, is now changed. We have a significant change then, let's say, in the virulence. There's an organism called Haemophilus aegypti. Haemophilus aegypti. Haemophilus aegypti causes a mild conjunctivitis. That is a little bit of irritation in your eye. It feels a little sandy in there. And there's a little bit of mucus in your eyes that's sort of stuck together. Okay. You might call, in general, it's a generic thing. It's a pink eye. Many causes of pink eye, but that's one of them. It's not a common cause, it's not common in the United States, but it is common throughout the world, though. Now, if you get this in the United States, this irritation is going to have you go to the doctor and you'll get antimicrobial agents and you'll get rid of it. However, recently, in the last 10 years or so, that's recent, we began to see a new problem. And the first patient of the new problem had what's called Brazilian purpuric fever. Purpura refers to your inability to clot. Brazilian purpuric fever, obviously you have a fever in the problem. And what's happening is, as seen in this little fellow who was in Brazil, and he came home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he played soccer, and he did, he played soccer in the afternoon. In Brazil, you have a stereotype. Playing soccer, and then he came home by 6, he was eating. By 7:30, I mean, he was only in 5th grade, so he was doing his homework at 7:30, and he noticed in his mother nurse that he had a couple little spots on his arm. And then she looked at the 10 spots in the belly, and little spots all over his body. Little tiny spots. These spots are called petechiae. Petechiae are local hemorrhages of the capillary bed. P-E-T-E-C-H-I-A-D, petechiae. So petechiae are these localized hemorrhages in the capillary bed, and he was seeing this effect. I didn't know what it was, and of course it gets bigger, and they start coalescing. The spots get bigger and clump together. He then started to have a fever, and he got really sleepy. Losing money. It was only 10:30 at night. His mother took him to the emergency room, and by midnight he was dead. Wow. In a matter of 4 or 5 hours, he went through being fine doing his homework to being dead. And what it was a exotoxin associated with the organism that the organism had just picked up in an exchange, a genetic exchange. Now, as it turns out, this is a hit or miss kind of thing. It's slowly coming around. It's going through the United States of Brazil. So if you travel in Central or South America, you are an American. You're part of the United States of America. You are not part of the United States. You take offense if you call yourself someone from the United States, but you're definitely the United States, too. Okay. United States of Venezuela, so it's a part of the American. Not the United States. So the United States of Brazil, this is showing up in different states, increasingly so. It's coming this way. It'll be in theaters soon. Okay. So we'll see this in the United States probably within the next 10 years or so. This is rather a remarkable kind of problem. Okay. And it just appears. You've heard of the Moffat fellow, right? I've talked about him before, right? There's people that Muppet guy, the guy that had the Muppets on television. These are emerging pathogens where organism had no, we have any idea what the organism caused, staph organism, it's a strep organism, it's a Haemophilus organism. We know what it does. And all of a sudden, one day, it does something new. Now, one of the characteristic features of intoxications, which is easily moved from place to place on the gene, is really true to toxin, is a rapidly fulminating disease course. Intoxication is often associated with a rapidly fulminating disease course, meaning you die quickly. You're intoxicated. And the degree is, of damage and the suddenness of the death is not related to massive growth of the organism, it's the significant release of the toxin. And these toxins are very, very potent in very small amounts. So we see this rapidly fulminating disease course, and then we know that we're suspicious that we're dealing with an exotoxin. And it can be an organism that the lab says it's staph aureus, you know how to deal with it. It's strep diogenes, you know how to deal with it. Except in this case, the patient died. Because we have to provide an awful lot of physical support to the patient in addition to antimicrobial treatment. Because antimicrobial treatment is going to take several days. This kid didn't have days. Hours. Drugs don't, antimicrobial agents don't work that fast. So we have to provide support. So we have to recognize the problem early, provide the appropriate support to the patient so they can live long enough for the antibiotics to wipe out the organism. See? Well, if this, and here we have a little review for you. We have F plus, HFR, F prime. A little table for you. Donor, at least if you could identify and so on. So, one of the clinical significance is this idea of virions, weapon system, toxins. And they will sometimes refer to these as emerging pathogens, as if they jumped out of a jungle someplace. But quite commonly, these emerging pathogens are the old bugs that we thought we knew have picked up a new information. And also antimicrobial resistance. ND, note to bend, something called an R factor. Let's take a look at one. This is a self-replicating plasmid found in an F prime cell. So an R factor is a special kind of F prime in which the genes associated with antimicrobial resistance are on that. So the A genes are associated with antimicrobial resistance. In this particular one, we have replication functions. That would be the ability to produce the transcriptase, for example. And then the resistance transfer factor information, that would be sort of like the sex pili. Okay. So the part that's in darker sort of orange and red and so on, well, that's part of what would be in a not in a F plus plasmid, okay, without anything added. And now we've taken an F plus plasmid and we've added things to it, the A genes. And here are the A genes. Antimicrobial resistance to erythromycin, penicillin, chlorpheniclone, and various heavy metals. So it's, we think of antimicrobial resistance, but we also realize there's resistance to detergents and all kinds of stuff. You know, one of the concerns that the microbiology community has about this let's wash our hands and the creation of all kinds of interesting chemicals that we can wash our hands with is that we're going to select for resistant organisms. Remember, the use of the antimicrobial agent selects for the resistance. It doesn't cause the resistance. One in a million is out there, but now we kill off everybody but, and therefore then all the offspring come from the resistant one. So there's the hand washing. You know, we're much more in favor of just soap and water. I think that's it. You start using compounds that have a significant bactericidal effect, we're going to select for organisms that cause problems. And so we'll see increased risk of infections of the skin with organisms that usually would have been wiped out but now are resistant. So it's not just that we have microbial agents, but you can see we have heavy metals and so on. So we have multiple antibiotic resistance associated with R factors that can spread through conjugation, through F prime mating. So if I ask you on an exam, how might antimicrobial resistance be spread? And the answer would be, it might be through transformation, it might be through transduction, and it might be through conjugation. But if I ask you how might multiple antibiotic resistance spread, what is the most common mechanism of spreading multiple antibiotic resistance, the answer is conjugation. And then if I have choices, and you expect to see these choices, if I have choices of various kinds of mating cells, that is, an F-plus cell, an HFR cell, an F-prime cell, and so on, and these donor cells, which of these donor cells is most commonly associated with the spread of multiple antibiotic resistance, the answer is F. The answer is F-prime. Now, can you spread antimicrobial resistance with HFR matings? Yes. And with, of course, F prime. Can you spread antimicrobial resistance with F plus cell matings? No. But HFR, yes. And with F prime, certainly. The same would be true if I had questions about when you spread a virulence factor, which we mentioned is toxins, but it could be, well, it produces a capsule, could be spread. And all kinds of things, but toxins most easiest. So toxins, changes in virulence factors could be spread by transformation, transduction, or conjugation. They can be more specifically spread by conjugation, HFR, and F prime. When you say the word multiple antibiotic resistance, think of an R factor. Now these R factors get bigger. We had, the organism adds more and more and more. We had an outbreak of dysentery many years ago, 25, 30 years ago, in Japan. And you may recall or may remember from the geography classes, Japan is a series of islands. And so on the different islands, like Honshu and so on the different islands, they were treating with different antimicrobial agents. And during the course of this epidemic, in a very short period of time, a matter of weeks, the epidemic lasted months, but in a matter of weeks, all the isolates on all the islands were resistant to multiple antibiotic resistant characteristics. That is, they were resistant to drugs that weren't even used on that island. Okay? Because the medical workers were going back and forth, and they were sharing it with them. And the organism became multiple antibiotic resistant. Okay. Once you pick up the R factor, you've got all the charms that it gives you. Okay. And if we're not using erythromycin on that island, but this R factor is given, then now the organism is resistant to erythromycin. They were hoping they could sort of use this one until it didn't work and then use the next one. Until it didn't work and then use the next one. But the organism was ahead of them. The organism became multiple antibiotic resistant in a very short period of time. We didn't know why at the time, but not know why. As these antimicrobial agents, as these R factors have become bigger, they become more stable. Remember we talked about that twisting, and I couldn't remember that. Is that what you're thinking about? Still can't remember. What is it? Jelly bracelet? No, not a bracelet. A waistlet. Anyway, so you have this bigger one, it's more stable, it will handle more shear forces. Okay? So as these R factors get bigger, and that more resistance become more problems, they actually become more stable. Not a good idea. And remember, we are part of the problem by the use of an antibiotic inappropriately, we select for resistance. And we'll talk more about that in a short time. But we use antimicrobial agents in feedlots so that the cows can gain weight, even though they're not sick. There are all kinds of use of antimicrobial agents in the biosphere, not just simply in people, but we also misuse it in people as well. 90% of upper respiratory tract infections are viruses, and we give people antibiotics for that. That's another example. Now for something that is a little bit mind-blowing, but it should fit some of the themes that we've talked about in the course. When we talk about things that, try to integrate ideas because we artificially create subjects like chemistry and biochemistry and inorganic chemistry and physical chemistry and anatomy and histology and physiology. geology and so on, it was sort of creating cool areas. In reality, the patient's got all that going on all the time. We break it up arbitrarily. Well, what we've done in this last presentation is arbitrarily bring up this idea of genetics, plus HFR, F prime, bacteriophage. Remember, it's all going on at the same time. So we have an approach called a theory. But it's very interesting and probably largely correct. It's called sexduction. Sexduction. Now, we talked about bacteriophage as having structures that look sort of like this, with the genomic information on the inside. And that was an example of a T-even phage. But there are other shapes. For example, something called tobacco mosaic virus and a bacteriophage known as M13 is long and thin like that. And it's got receptor sites at the end, and it's got the nucleic acid sitting in the inside. Well, what if we have the possibility of something like an M13 that invades a cell, bacterial cell, and it lands on the outside like that, and it injects its nucleic acid inside in a linear form, but then something weird happens. One of those endonucleases clips it a little bit. A little bit of a scavenger enzyme going around. So what if we have an enzyme that breaks down that little bit of DNA that's snipping it a little bit? And what happens then is that we start off with a cell, and now we then go to another kind of cell. Right? When it clips, it makes the sticky ends and it circularizes. So this aborted infection, as we can call it, results in our first F plus cell. So we had an F minus cell, which is the normal state, and we have a virus with that's lost bits and pieces. It has the ability to make its nucleocapsid slash sex villi. And it has the ability to copy itself, as the new viruses do. Okay. But it's lost all the other stuff that we have. So that creates our first F plus cell. An aborted virus infection. Well, what if we have something that looks like this? That's the way. Here's our first HFR cell. And it's sort of like lysine. Because we know viruses can insert their information into the genome. So we made a stable relationship. It still produces its transcriptases, which you can copy yourself. It still produces nucleic acid slash bacteriophage that has receptor sites for bacterial cells. And it's not by accident that it's also small enough and the right diameter inside that a linear form of that genetic information can get through that slash sex pill or slash nucleic acid.
What is that word?
What
I saw it. A
late viral infection? Aborted viral infection. Aborted. So it was interrupted. So we went from an F minus cell, which is the natural state, to our first M plus cell with an inner and screwed up viral invasion. And the nucleocapsid of the virus is actually the sex phyllotype. The internal diameter will exactly right perfectly hold a linear form of that viral genome slash sex self-replicating plasmid. So now what happens? We have another male cell. This is our first prime cell. And this is sort of like transduction. Now it's stolen. It's stolen the A gene from the main chromosome. But it never leaves the cell in the chromosome, right? And under normal circumstances, it would spread through a conjugation. And then, we go back to an F minus cell. Ongoing interaction between bacterial cells and bacterial viruses and constantly moving information around. And it has consequences for us. So we're seeing more of this, more than one mechanism for resistance to penicillin, but the penicillinase, one of the earlier ones, is moving towards the non-self-replicating. So that's the third one. It's being spread by transduction. So this is what we call sexduction, conjugation and transduction together. It's the bigger picture of how things flow. It demonstrates that these structures of F plus HFR F prime are not static, but they are constantly moving around. A little bit about Barbara McClintock, just to introduce the idea that we get built upon subsequent protein. What we talked about is what's going on in prokaryotic cells, how viruses can do things and so on. Now, human cells have chromosomes, multiple of them. They don't have plasmids that we're aware of. But they are invaded by viruses. And Barbara McClintock, okay, is an interesting person in the history of this study, because she felt that using corn as the as her model, corn plant, as a model of a eukaryotic cell, she felt that there were something going on that was changing the genetic information, that was moving it around, that accounted for changes in the genetics of the plant that were not simply because of crossing and fertilizing and building genetics. Something else was going on. Something was moving things around. She called that something a transposon. The transposon has two parts. The part that inserts into the chromosome section in the DNA, called an insertion sequence, IS, insertion sequence. And it could be just an insertion sequence alone. It just moves around, not thinking anything at all, just going from place to place. That would be really analogous to F plus, wouldn't it? This is moving around, not thinking anything with it. And of course, that was, we just theorized, that's part of the virus. So we have this virus-like kind of piece of DNA that's moving around, but it's not thinking anything. But then it can also insert itself and then take something with it. Now it's called a transposon. So the smallest transposon is just simply an insertion sequence. So typically we're seeing transposons that have genes attached to them. Now it can come in and steal all kinds of things. It may pick up a regulatory gene. So that we have now, remember the operon level structure? We have operator, regular, regulator. We pick up those operator genes, the regulator gene, and pick it up and put it someplace else. So now you have an operon sitting there, and it's got five different structural genes that are enzymes for some pathway or something. And they're all being turned off because the repressor protein is sitting on the operator and nothing's happening. Along comes a transposon and inserts itself in the middle of those five with its own directions to turn it on. Even though the first main thing was turned off, these things are being turned on. We see this in certain kinds of cancers. Might this be one mechanism of development of the cancer? Might this be some sort of link then between some viruses and some cancers? These are open questions at this point. But clearly, our genetic information is being moved around as well. Okay. So transposons, you could think of them conceptually as like a vestigial virus, just like we can think conceptually, F plus, HFR, and so on. So that model, that concept that we just went through for the bacterial world, although we don't have plasmids, there are genetic elements that are moving around. Now, when she came up with the idea, she was working in plants. Everybody else was working in bacteria. She was a she. Everybody else was a he. And there was a lot of problems with her even getting funded for her research. As you can see, she got Nobel Prize. So the same group of people that blocked her from getting research grants, shunned her at meetings, laughed at her openly and publicly, ultimately, if you go to Cold Springs Harvard, which is a molecular think tank out in Long Island in an old whaling village, Cold Springs Harvard, you go there, they named the building after her. Not a very deep building, but it's one of their labs. Analogous to, remember, it had some noise. The same group, same society, years later, meeting was open. If you're curious about her, you Google her name, and you'll find she has a neat book out that you can read about her science, as well as her struggle as a woman in science. It's a very interesting story. Okay. So, genetic transposition, the use of transposons. So, probably 25 or 30 years from now, we'll have to work out more fully. And so the lectures will go from, this is what we learned about bacteria, and here's sex function, and now we're going to move into human cells, and here's all things around the body, this kind of cancer, that kind of cancer. We're not quite there yet, but we're moving in that direction. Again, concepts can be applied in different settings. Antimicrobial agents. Now, in this section, we actually have two kinds of handouts. You have the handout that's part and parcel of the overhead. And then you have another handout that begins with something that looks complicated. Antimicrobial drugs, antibiotics, and synthetic agents. Okay, you see that? And it's between the numerical pages, it's the next page after this last one we saw, and it precedes page 50. Okay. So we're going to look at these sort of simultaneously, so you might want to pull those out that I just put online so you can have them side by side. Did you ever find the extra handout? Here. There are now 80 of the 71 in the class, and yet there's at least, how many people don't have their hand up? Everybody get a copy? Okay. There was a couple people saying they didn't have one. We'll start with that inserted handout, the one that we just described, which is historical development. And we want to get an idea of what's going on here. In our historical developments, in our historical developments, we see before 1600, see that? We have the indigenous population of Peru making a tea and chewing the bark of the chincona tree. And they were doing that to prevent a disease, or to treat a disease, or to treat a disease that caused fever in children. This is in Peru, indigenous population. Unsophisticated people. The Europeans at the same time, dealing with the same disease, the Italians were the leading thought process there, the Italians thought it was a bad air disease, malaria, and they thought the product of the anaerobic respiration producing H2S bubbling up from the swamp, that the smell caused the disease. They had not a clue about the malaria parasite. Again, this is malaria, not a bacterial agent, but a parasitic organism. But here we have, you carry on yourself. So we have completely different mindsets, okay? One thinks the smell is causing, and of course, that led to them sealing up the buildings, and ultimately the buildings got hot, and they exchanged the air, and they developed crude forms of air conditioning. Meanwhile, the indigenous population in Peru is taking quinine. Quinine is still a mainstay, although we have various modifications of quinine, to treat malaria. Malaria is a significant worldwide pathogen. Millions of people die. Many of them younger children. Following World War II, we used DDT to wipe out the mosquitoes. And guess what? They became resistant to DDT. So DDT doesn't work very well. And the earlier drugs in America that were the first derived drugs for quinine and so on, now the organism's resistant to that. So the mosquitoes are resistant to the DDT, the malarial parasites are resistant to the earlier forms of quinine. This process of use of a drug and then developing a selective drug resistance occurs with bacteria, it occurs with viral infections, it occurs with parasitic infections. We're just sort of seeing a little glimpse of sort of an evolutionary process in which we create the evolutionary pressure with the drug or the DDT or whatever. So we have this process, but eventually the Europeans discover quinine. I always find that interesting. They're the same people that discovered America. Like, we didn't know who we were when we were here. Native population didn't know they were something. Where they were, the Europeans were on their way to India. They were in India. But the idea is that when we have solutions to problems, and we don't have to pick on the Europeans, because we can pick on ourselves as well, the Western world, the sophisticated scientists in Berkeley and Harvard and U of M and so on, have to realize that the indigenous world has solutions to problems that need to be explored. And there's a whole host of new information that can be gathered by going back into the annual, so to speak, going back into the indigenous population and finding out what they're doing and why they're doing it. They don't have the science behind it, but they have experience behind it. They know what works because they've tried other things that didn't work and people die. They find something that works and they use it. We may scoff at it because it doesn't fit our concept of the right answer, but it may be the right answer. So again, there'll be new products that will come out, whether it's treating cancer or treating diseases. They're going to come out of places that are indigenous populations, so we don't want to simply scoff at them. Okay? We want to understand what they're doing. They may, in fact, know what they're doing, as was the case with quinine. Okay? But that was our first attempt to intervene in the disease process. So that was sort of a step forward. We have an intentional delivery, intentional interaction with the parasite. 1600. Nothing much happens for a couple of centuries. Long time. One of the things we want to understand in this history session is the actual use of antimicrobial agents is a relatively recent event in the history of mankind, and yet we already have significant development of antimicrobial resistance. And although you've grown up in a period of time in which you and your parents, and to some degree your grandparents, were protected against organisms, bacterial organisms, with the use of antibiotics, your grandchildren may not be so lucky. We may have run the course of antimicrobial agents. This could be the golden era. We may be seeing the end of the golden era of the use of antimicrobial agents. Something to be sort of aware of. So the idea of antimicrobial resistance, the idea of R factors of resistance, is not like, oh, that's just an isolated thing, we'll work around it, it'll be fine. No, this is the tip of a thread we're pulling on, and when we pull the next scenery in, or this next stage, it's a much worse situation. We're going to be back the way we were. We'll have these drugs, but they won't work anymore. Just like the quinine that was originally developed doesn't work. Just like the DDT doesn't work. So, our next thing that we're going to cross, we see is Salmersan. We actually have a picture of Salmersan. Salmersan, interesting fellow. Paul Ehrlich, 1909-1910. He is working as a chemist, and he's trying to develop a drug that would intervene in the process. Much like the malaria. And the disease that he's trying to treat is a sexually transmitted disease that was incurable and fatal. Boy, does that sound familiar. Like AIDS. Then it was treponema pallidum. It was syphilis. So he's trying to develop a drug treatment for syphilis. Never been done before. Where do you begin? When do you quit? He called this compound 606 because the first 605 tries failed. Imagine that. 605 failures and you get up on a Monday morning and give it another shot. It's never been done before. Maybe it can't be done. How many people you know started off with tree farm, didn't get past inorganic chemistry and said, well, that's enough of that? How many people didn't make it through organic chemistry and said, well, I can't do it? Well, couldn't you repeat the class? No, I'm done. I quit. That teacher did it. That test was too much, too tough. 605, it can't be done. It's never been done before. And he tried 606. So that's when he comes up with sour sands. You can see we've got heavy metals in there and so on. A bit toxic. But it worked. We also learned some other things about this. To deliver a drug to a disease that's got a social stigma to it. Well, we had storefronts. That is, the front of the store would be something, and in the back you'd get your salvation job. Rather than saying, we're open for business, come and get it. If you've got sexually transmitted diseases, come on in. People didn't want to do that. And so they did it behind stores. So they had storefronts with something else. Hat stores, or whatever it might be, flowers, or, and you go in the back and you come up with a flower later, but then a hat. But you also got your shot of sour sand. They developed an odd kind of reaction, though. Some of the patients developed, or maybe you can figure it out, some of the patients developed a yellowing of their skin if they were Caucasians, yellowing of the whites of their eyes, abdominal pain, and fever as a reaction to sour sand. Early we couldn't figure it out. What kind of jaundice? Liver problem, okay. And what kind of thing could that be?
Heavy metal poisoning.
Not the heavy metal poisoning. That was thought of, but threw out. Hepatitis B. Now, hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease as well as is syphilis. And sexually transmitted diseases often come in groups. We'll talk about that later in the course. So it's often a mixed infection. You don't just get one thing. Remember the fellow that injected himself with the extract of the woman who had gonorrhea and then died of syphilis. Remember that fellow, John Hunter? Well, these patients had syphilis and they have hepatitis B. Some of them. And how do they deliver it? Well, they gave the people shots. And how do they do that? Well, they load the syringe up with salvarsan and give a person a shot. And they load up the syringe and give somebody else a shot. And they load up the syringe and give somebody else a shot. See a problem here? They're spraying hepatitis because they're using the same needle again and again and again and again. So the problem was not a problem with salvarsan, it was a problem in the delivery system. Okay? And as odd as that sounds, as well, that can't be a problem anymore. We know about that. That's not true. We've had outbreaks of HIV in Moscow. We've had in Sarajevo and several other places in the world because they're using the same needles to give shots. And it spreads from person to person to person. We've even had situations in the United States where we use, to observe your upper intestinal tract, we have a tube that we can search. Okay, we've got a camera on it and we can look. Okay. And when you're over age 50 or so, it's something you'll have to endure, it looks like. Unless we develop a little camera that you swallow it. We'll see. Until then, we have this tube to stick out there. And those are sort of complicated kind of machineries. And, you can autoclave them, but no, they're expensive. A hospital may have, 20 of them, 15 of them. But, you got to make money on this thing. So what hospitals have done and are now being called in the carpet for, particularly VA hospitals, but others as well, they would sort of wipe it down and use it again. Because it's sort of, downtime is not good. So at nighttime they autoclave these things. But, you've got so many instruments, 10 instruments, and you're going 35 people a day. It just doesn't add up, right? You're just wiping it off on the next person. So they're spreading diseases that way. Don't figure. Who does that would spread a disease that way, right? So this idea that they had problems with 1909 and 1910 was because of their ignorance. Well, that ignorance is not gone. Just because we know the answer doesn't mean everybody does the right thing. They don't always think. So, some things to learn from Salvorsen. The delivery system can be a problem. That when we have a sexually transmitted disease, we have a problem in terms of getting the right treatment to the patients. And we have to deal with that. But the other interesting thing was Paul Ehrlich. He had a single-minded, he was looking for that thing. And he was going to find it if it took him forever. And he died and didn't find it. So he was really a single-minded. Our next compound, so this was 1909, 1910. The next compound discovery was by a guy named John Jack. And this is 1935, or thereabouts. 1930s. What else could he do? A double thing there? He did the sneeze and then we'll learn it. So Don Jack gets credit for having discovered sulfonamide, sulfur drugs. Now, this is a whole series of serendipitous events. This was not the way Ehrlich did it. It was just a whole series of luck events. How many luck events in a row? Amazing number. Pure luck, when you think of, we had no drugs except for syphilis, is all we could treat. Sulfa drug was another major thing up here that affected many different organisms. We have a young girl who has a staph infection on her arm. And it comes from the upper part of her hand up to her elbow. That's important. Another part of the body, no discovery. Her favorite color is sort of a royal blue kind of color. Also a purplish kind of color. That's important. She has a different favorite color. This doesn't work. No discovery. Her grandmother knits her a sweater in her favorite color. That's important. Had she bought it, it might not have worked. Her birthday was on a school day. That was important. Not, doesn't work. It rains on her birthday. Must have, can't do it without it. She wears her sweater to school. It gets wet, and she sits all day long in school with this wet sweater, and the dye, her favorite color, Promethazine rubrum, soaks into the skin. When she comes home, she's blue from her wrist to her elbow. Both arms and a few days later, her mother notices that, you know, your rash is going away from the wrist up, but it's still the same on your hand. There must have been something in the dye that's killing the organism. Let's check with Don Jack. So Don Jack looks at this girl's arm, it's still a little bit blue, and looks at it, there's something in the dye that's killing the organism, and he writes the paper and gets credit for it. Now remember, if she has a different favorite color, if it doesn't rain, if it's a school day, if it's not a birthday, all those things have to happen for her to sit for 6 hours with the stain in her arm. Okay? And then John Jack makes the after the mother told him to look. So we have discovered this compound. Purified forms are made. They are yellow powder. They're not highly purified. And sulfur drugs, which we'll see, interfere with the making of folic acid, dihydrotetrahydrofolic acid. Folic acid is what you call is involved in one carbon unit biosynthetic reactions. So it interferes with the making of carbon units. And that is what the sulfa drug is doing. So the sulfa drug is the only thing we have. We have sulfa drug, we have quinine, and we have Salvorsen. And we start at World War. Okay. Well, we have World War II. And so you may see the old pictures of movies where they call a medic and he puts open a package of stuff and he throws it on the wound. That was probably not very effective for reasons we'll talk about later, but that was what we had. Okay? Yes?
In the notes, it says that the sulfonamide came first, so that went through.
Come first.
Before the myself?
Yes. The notes are the right order.
Sorry.
in the right way. Yeah, you've been looking in the right way. Story of the onion.
So we have this, we start World War II, and we don't have penicillin yet. We start World War II with just this stuff. Now, when there's wars, people get wounded, and most people in wars, historically, you don't die of being shot in the head or something like that. Most people die of infections. These are more people that are wounded but live than actually get shot and die. And the wounded live, then die of infection. So more people die of infection than they do of actual gunshot wounds or being blown apart. And of course, if you're dead, it doesn't make any difference what, why you die, you can't go back to the front to fight. So countries on all sides of the war want to keep their soldiers healthy so they can keep the war going on. So there are significant wartime enterprises on all sides of the war to try to develop vaccines in some cases against infections, and also antimicrobial agents. Now, one of those people who is working is Wachmann in New Jersey. Wachmann is in New Jersey, Rutgers University, and he is looking for these drugs. He's more like an early kind of guy, really persistent. And he's looking all over the environment for compounds that are produced by microorganisms that inhibit other microorganisms. And he discovers penicillin. But when they check in the literature, it had already been discovered. Alexander Fleming had discovered it in 1929. And he demonstrated that it worked, and he was a microbiologist, he had a job. And so he wrote up papers or two, and then he went back to his job. And it disappeared in the literature. And it sat there until Walker discovers it in the early 1940s. Okay. So it wasn't available when the war started. But during the war, it gets rediscovered. So the mold of penicillium produces the compound penicillin. And in the early work done by Fleming in 1929, he also had this serendipitous discovery where he had the mold growing on a plate that he had a patient isolated of staph. And the organism was growing on a plate. And then the mold blew in the window and got on his plate. And it was a little bit serendipitous because had he been a neat microbiologist, he would have thrown away the plate before the mold even grew. But he went on a fortnight vacation, 2-week vacation, 10 days. And when he came back, he had this artifact growing. Because he didn't do his dishes before he left. He was trying to do it. It was all no plastic. Everything was glass. So he had his glass feature plates and he had to reuse them. And so that's what he discovers this. Pure accident. But when he saw it, he knew something was up. That big, fuzzy, white mold with the little black spores on it was secreting something that was inhibiting the organism. He knew he saw his quadrant streaking. He knew where the organism was. And now they had this mold growing on the edge of the plate that was killing everything. Okay. It takes a little bit of work to do this. Of course, he did it by accident initially. And I've done it in the rest of my individual things. And the mold grows at room temperature, and the organism grows at body temperature, and you got to grow them both in the same place. And they grow at different rates. So there's a lot of interesting things that just actually happened by accident initially, but ultimately you can figure it out. So then he isolates the mold, and he isolates the penicillin from the mold, and he dropped in a liquid form, and he put it on a plate, and he showed inhibition. He even tried it in a patient. A patient was dying of a bacterial infection. They used the stuff, and then they ran out of stuff. And they took the guy's urine and re-isolated it again to give it back to him, but they didn't have enough and he died. But he got better, but then he died because they didn't have enough. So he indicated that it had a clinical implication. Could be a drug. 1929 comes and goes, and it's gone in the literature. So although it's been discovered, it was not practically available. It's rediscovered in World War II. So we now have an industrial industry created since World War II to find drugs. And they look all over the place to find drugs. So that's sort of the beginning of the second half of the last century. So we've been a big deal in the drug industry since World War II. So since 1950s to now, is only 60 years or so.
In 60 years, we've created all kinds of new drugs, and we have selected for all kinds of antimicrobial resistance. That's why I talk about this, the zenith, the high point. And we seem to be on the other side. We are not creating new drugs as commonly as we did in the 1950s. We're not creating drugs nearly as fast as the organisms are becoming resistant to drugs. So we are now, a little bit late, but now we're trying to be very careful about the use of the drug. But we've already selected for significant resistance and what otherwise be good drugs. One of the strategies we have now, when we develop a new drug, we don't use it. We withhold it. We don't use it. And we use it only when we actually, everything else fails. So, some tricks there. Some definitions for us now. Again, still on that handout, that extra handout. The key definition. An antimicrobial agent is any compound, regardless of origin, that has an inhibitory effect on microorganisms. Any compound, regardless of origin, that has an inhibitory effect on microorganisms. So that microorganism we're talking about could be a bacteria, could be a fungal organism, could be a virus. And that any origin could be another microbial organism, or it could be a compound like salicylic, chemical compound. And an antibiotic is an antimicrobial agent of microbial origin. Organisms produce compounds in the latter phase of log and early stationary phase, the secondary metabolites that we refer to. And these secondary metabolites in lat, their log, and early stationary are the ones that are the ones that produce some of these, in fact, such things as antibiotics. And we can grow the organisms in these chemostats. I think we talked about that before. But the chemostat basically keeps the conditions about the same. And so we extend that period of time in late log, early stationary, which might otherwise last for only a few hours. We can extend it to several days. So drug companies have these big fermenters, and we monitor pH and so on, oxygen concentration, and we keep that secondary metabolite stage longer than normal, stretch it out, get lots of antimicrobial agent. So an antibiotic is from another microorganism. A synthetic agent or a chemotherapeutic agent is just simply a chemical. A synthetic agent or a chemotherapeutic agent is simply a chemical. And of course, this idea of selective toxicity we talked about in your class, in the round. Some examples of antibiotics are listed there. We'll talk more about some of them later. We've got penicillin, we produce the mold penicillium, cephalosporin, we produce the mold cephalosporium. We have genus Bacillus producing a variety of things, and synthesized from erythromycin. All of these are naturally occurring compounds that are produced by microorganisms since they're antibiotics. For bacteria, mold, so on. We also have some spectrum of action considerations, the range over which the organism is affected. Spectrum of action is the range over which the antimicrobial agent is affected. If it's broad spectrum, it works equally well with gram-positive and gram-negative organisms. And therefore, that little polysaccharide layer is not a significant hindrance to the drug getting inside. Or we can have a narrow spectrum agent, which generally works better on gram-positive organisms than gram-negative, because it has trouble with the little polysaccharide layer getting in. So the spectrum of action is not on the basis of the target so much as it is, can it get to the target? So there are examples of gram-negative organisms that penicillin still works in and so on, but in general, we have these spectrums of action. Then we have limited spectrum of action in which the organism, the antimicrobial agent, generally works on a single genera. For example, isoniazid, or INH as it's called, blocks the making of glycolic acid, and therefore it's effective only with acid-fast organisms. So we use it for tuberculosis and leprosy and so on. That's a narrow spectrum. excuse me, that's limited spectrum. So we got broad, equally well with gram-positive and gram-negative, narrow, generally works with gram-positive and more, and gram-negative, and limited, one genera, such as isoniazid working on mycobacteria. We also have whether it's bactericidal or bacteriostatic, which deals with the mechanism of action. Now, bactericidal simply means it kills the cell. In a rather abrupt manner. Bacteriostatic means it generally shuts down something like protein synthesis or some synthetic process, some biosynthetic reaction series, and it starves the cell. They die, but it's a slower process. Basically, they stop growing. And there are obvious problems if we use them together. For example, if we use a bacteriostatic agent with penicillin. Remember, penicillin affects the growing cell wall. If you use a bacteriostatic agent with it, then the cell is not growing, so therefore penicillin is not effective. There's some obvious kinds of problems. There are also some drugs, depending upon the concentration that we use the drug, at one concentration they can be bacteriostatic, but at a higher concentration they can be bactericidal. Some drugs that cross over that. First mechanism of action, or let's say the first category of drug action, cell wall sentence inhibitors. Now, if we look at these, and there are five categories of action. As we look at these categories of action, you should recognize the following. Some of these, you should recognize the examples that we give you. There are many examples, but you'll get more of that with Dr. Krieger. But here we just want to give you sort of a framework from which you can then add new information. So we want to know the mechanism of action. So as you see in the handout, the cell wall sentence inhibitors and membrane disruptors and RNA DNA sentence inhibitors and protein sentence inhibitors and competitive inhibitors and so on. So we need to know the category. We also need to have an understanding of what is the basis, the common basis of selective toxicity. Why does it not cause us problems? Why does it cause the organism problems? We also have one of an understanding of some of the mechanisms of antimicrobial resistance. Again, I'm just going to give you some examples. You'll get much more greater detail later. And if there are some significant side effects, we'll mention them as well. Okay, so let's begin with cell wall sentence inhibitors. First one we want to think of, course, is penicillin. Now, penicillin has this interesting beta-lactam structure . We go to the red arrow line. And that four-membered ring structure is what interferes with the transpeptidation reaction of the urine layer. That is, that MM linkage. The enzyme that's supposed to make the linkage has a greater binding affinity for the beta-lactam ring. And therefore, the cross linkage is not made, the linear polymers unravel, and osmotic lysis occurs. So penicillin will be a bactericidal agent because of osmotic lysis. Well, the initial compound of penicillin, has some problems. It was not acid stable, so you couldn't take it orally. That's a problem. That means it had to be injected. That's the delivery system problem. And of course, it has to be injected by a healthcare professional. And you'd much rather have a pill that you take every so often and not have to get shot every so often. So we had to modify it. And we quickly realized that we could do almost anything to this interesting molecule as long as we didn't mess with the lactam ring. So we take the natural compound and we chemically modify it. So we send it off to the organic chemist and we say, we want something that's acid stable. So they modified it and came up with a semi-synthetic derivative of penicillin. So we took the natural compound and we modified it. We call that a semi-synthetic derivative. And we're so pleased that worked so well that they make pills that are now acid that they said, well, you know, penicillin is a narrow spectrum agent. It works primarily with gram-positive organisms, with a few gram-negative. Gonorrhea organisms seem to work with those developed resistance, but there's a few crossovers. But in general, it doesn't work well with gram-negative. So let's see if we can modify it so we can get through that outer layer. Remember, its target is still there, but it can't get through that lipopolysaccharide layer. So it's just a matter of hydrophilic, hydrophobic stuff. So let's change some of these R groups so that we can get it in. See if we can do that for organic chemists. So they sent it off to organic chemists. Organic chemists came back with ampicillin, a semi-synthetic derivative of the mold product, the natural product of penicillin, coming from the mold penicillium. And ampicillin is broad spectrum. This was great. We now have a new wonder drug, a broad spectrum penicillin compound. Then we started seeing some problems. It didn't take too long. We're in the 1950s and early 60s. We got problems of antimicrobial resistance. The organism is producing a beta-lactamase, an enzyme that's lying there, that's terrible, attacking the beta-lactam ring. And it's chewing up penicillin and ampicillin. So, let's say what we need to have is a penicillin that is not affected by penicillinase. We need to protect that beta-lactam ring. We need to put an R group there to protect it from this enzyme. And so we did. And we got methicillin. Wow, this is great. And we got a problem. First problem with methicillin was we went back to this thing being narrow spectrum again. It wasn't broad spectrum. And then the organism developed a different beta-lactamase. We now have a methicillinase that chews up the beta-lactam ring of methicillin. Wow, this is not going well. We found we had this all knocked. We just sent things off to Van Hemert and they could do it. So what we wanted was a broad spectrum, methicillinase, penicillinase resistant cell wall synthesis inhibitor. Okay? And they couldn't come up with it. They couldn't make two changes, making a broad spectrum at the same time resistant to these beta-lactamases. So, it turns out a bunch of scientists working in London in the Thames River downstream from a sanitation center found a new mold, Cephalosporium. And this new mold produced a new wonder drug, Cephalosporium. Keflex, Keflin, because the treatment is still gone. So Cephalosporium is a broad spectrum penicillinase-resistant, methicillinase-resistant compound. Ta-da! We finally made it. We got everything solved. We have completed the system. We're all done. We can fire all the organic chemists. We don't need them anymore. And then, of course, the organisms develop a cephalosporinase, which is another beta-lactamase, because cephalosporinase is beta-lactam ring 2. Ah! It's not one bug, so it keeps changing. Right? So you see a pattern here. We develop a drug, we use the drug, we have some resistance to the drug. We develop a new drug, use the drug, we get resistance to the drug. It's cycling even faster and faster and faster. This is not good news. And once, of course, we have the organisms developing a beta-lactamase, the penicillinase, or the beta-lactamase, the methicillinase, or the beta-lactamase, the cephalosporinase, those are three different ways of attacking that beta-lactam ring. Once they get it, of course, they skim with each other and give away through transformation, transduction, and conjugation, in particular in R factors. And so it spreads among the population. So if you treat a patient with a drug and the bug becomes wiped out, except for a few of them, that bug that had to begin the disease spreads it to your normal flora. Ah! So the next time you get another bad bug who doesn't have all these charm cards of resistances, it comes back and gives it its resistance to the new pathogen. So we select for it. How does a drug know where to go? It goes everywhere. It changes the gut flora. It changes the normal flora throughout the body. The more we use the drugs in the patient, the more problems we have with that patient. So therefore, if we have patients who have a chronic history of infections, like cancer patients and so on, or we're working with isolates of organisms from the cancer floor, chronic disease patients, they have a lot more antimicrobial resistance. In a hospital setting, a hospital-acquired agent is more likely to be resistant to many things than the community-acquired agent. Different parts of the hospital, in the hospital versus out of the hospital, all these are different patterns of resistances. The more we use the drug, the more we can't use the drug. This is not something going away, this is something getting worse. So now we have the cephalosporins. Have we learned anything? Well, sort of. We keep developing new names with all of the penicillins. We have penicillin, ampicillin, ampicillin. Let's not do that again. So we call them generations. We have the first generation cephalosporins, and the second generation cephalosporins, and the third generation, and so on, as we keep making the R group changes, keeping the beta-lactam membrane structure in there. We now have six, seven generations of cephalosporins. But we don't use them all, because we know as soon as we use them, we're going to lose them. Okay? And so what we do is we prioritize. Can this particular organism be treated with something simple like penicillin? Or do we have to use something more complicated, like a cephalosporin, or even like Keflex or Keflex, or maybe down the line different generations? So we try to triage the use of the drugs. Use the drugs in a particular order so that we don't use them before we have to use them. One step in the right direction. So we do have cephalosporins that we haven't used. But we know going on well, as soon as we start using them, within 5 years we will lose them. And we will lose patients. So people that used to die in the 1930s of common childhood bacterial infections are now living because we can treat them. But in the year 2030, all bets are off. We don't know what it's going to be like. Next time, we'll talk further about double-stranded inhibitors, and we'll go through the other five categories.